Turning now to the book of Genesis, chapter 11 and verse 1. Genesis chapter 11, verse 1. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And our subject is the deep significance of the Tower of Babel. But before coming to chapter 11, I'd like to call you to look at a number of verses in the preceding chapters. Chapter 9 and verse 1, God blessed Noah and his sons, and said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. That's the command of God. It comes all the way down from the Garden of Eden. And it is the command, the post-flood command to Noah and his family. And they are to be fruitful, to multiply and replenish the earth, which means to spread through the earth. Now that's after the flood, according to the traditional calculations, 1,656 years after the flood. 101 years after that, after this instruction to Noah, comes the event of the Tower of Babel. Now if you'd just like to look at chapter 10 and verse 1, these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and unto them were sons born after the flood. Now there are the three sons, Shem, you'll recall, I don't want to recapitulate, but Shem is the godly line. Ham was under a distinctive curse from God because of his sin, and Japheth evidently wasn't a lot better. But Shem is the one who is the bearer of the godly seed, and he is the representative of the godly line. And as we've been studying these chapters, you've seen that there is conflict, or at least hostility, from the seed of the serpent, that is the ungodly, towards the godly, those who believe and obey the Lord, in the line now of Noah and of Shem. So Shem is the godly line. And then down to verse 5 of chapter 10, By these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, everyone after his tongue, after their families, in their nations. Now this refers to particularly the sons of Ham and the references to them, but it's the words that I want you to look at. These were the isles of the Gentiles, probably the Mediterranean area, divided in their lands, everyone after his tongue. This is after the confusion of tongues, following chapter 11. This is the case, and yet they're organized after their families in their nations. It's all very orderly. Don't let the confusion of tongues, the instrument that God used through the Tower of Babel, leads you to think that there was a haphazard dispersal of the people. The different languages were given, each to the different tribes or groupings of family, and they were to go and be dispersed to places that God had determined. It was actually very organized. There was something they already knew about, the lands to which they should go. At least, that's a fair assumption. So we note that is in there in chapter 10 and verse 5. And then going down, we could look at a number of verses, but I want to get on to chapter 11. Going down to verse 25 of chapter 10, Unto Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. Now this is particularly interesting to us. There's Shem, and then there's Selah, and then there's Eber. And so we've come down in verse 25 to Eber, of the godly line, a descendant of Shem. Eber. Now Jewish tradition has it, but for no good reason necessarily, but it's possible that Eber did not cooperate in the building of the Great Tower. And as the result, according to Jewish tradition, there's no note of this in the Bible, as the result, because Eber and his family, the godly nine, were not cooperative, therefore their language was left to them. And from Eber you get Hebrew, and so the Jews used to claim, they don't now so much, but they used to claim that Hebrew was the original language of Adam. Well, it's very unlikely that that was the case, not a note of it anywhere in the Bible, but it's not unlikely that Eber refused to cooperate in the building of the Tower of Babel, because he was, and his family, represented the godly line, and the Tower of Babel was an act of rebellion against God, which I'll explain. But in verse 25, unto Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg. And that's an interesting name, because it means division. For in his days was the earth divided. So Peleg was evidently born at the time of Babel. And so he was named the division. And from this we can roughly date, according to the old chronology, we can date at least from the creation, if not backwards from now, the time of the confusion of tongues then. So remember chapter 9 and verse 1, there is this great command that the people should multiply and that they should go throughout the earth. But this was an orderly thing. Now I'm going to take you to one or two scriptures, because it's most important. I'll do this quickly. Before we proceed with our study, it's important to get something across, and then everything will fall into place. So in Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse 7, we read this. This is Moses declaring to the people, years later, speaking under inspiration, remember the days of old. This was in their history. They knew all about this much later on in the time of Moses. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask thy father and he will show thee, not because he was there, but because they all knew their national history. Ask thy elders and they will tell thee. When the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel, for the Lord's portion is his people. Now, friends, this actually doesn't refer to the land apportioned to Israel. This refers back long before then to all the nations, where they should go, where they should live. It was a very orderly thing, and God determined it. Now, you get the impression from the history of the Tower of Babel that it might be a haphazard thing, that God confused their languages and they were dispersed. But this was a planned thing. They knew where they were to go. And I wish to explain this because, believe me, everything will make much better sense. I can turn to the book of Acts for a moment and to verse 17. And here's a very interesting reference in chapter 17 and verse 26. And this great statement of Paul in his Mars Hill sermon, God hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation. Now, that could be just a very general statement, but it appears most strongly to refer back to the history of Genesis, that God determined the places, the destinations to which the tribes would disperse and where they would go. And so because of this, I'm going back now to Genesis and chapter 11. Because of this, the old exegetes, commentators and writers always used to say that though it isn't declared here, it looks very much as though God, perhaps through Eber, perhaps years before, through Shem, or perhaps through one of the other descendants in the godly line. Eber is the favourite. God revealed to him how the people would go to the different parts of the earth and where they should go. But the people didn't want to go. They wouldn't do it. It's obvious that they disobeyed the general command of God, and they got as far as the plain of Shinar in old Babylonia, and there they stopped, and they wouldn't disperse any further. So God had to do something that would force them to disperse. So at least we know they rebelled against the command of God to the human race, but more specifically, all the old interpreters used to say they rebelled against something more. They rebelled, most likely, against the clear instruction, direction, preaching, if you like, given to them by Eber or someone of his standing. We should do this. We should do this. And they wouldn't listen to the representative of the godly line. And this used to be the view that was taken because it's also orderly. They were dispersed according to the directions of God. That's what the other texts say. So it didn't just happen. Their rebellion, by building the Tower of Babel and staying right there in the plain of Shinar, was not just a rebellion to God's command through Noah, which was passed down to them, but to even more specific instructions. You will go here, you will go there, you will go there. And they weren't going to do it. So I wanted to explain that. You won't find that in the modern study Bibles, because these modern study Bibles do not interpret the Bible in the traditional, according to the traditional rules of interpretation. It's terribly sketchy. But if you go to, say, something which many of you will have at home, if you go to Matthew Henry, you'll find this traditional view carefully laid out before you. And any of the old Bible dictionaries, the famous commentaries, and so on. But here, now this is how it was done. And we come to chapter 11. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. Not Hebrew, necessarily. And it came to pass, verse 2, by the way, the estimates of how many people there were vary. The lowest estimate was that at this point, after the flood, remember, by the flood, the world was put back to only 8 people. Noah and his family. And the estimates are that now, probably the lowest, there are 1,000 people. The highest, 36,000, very plausibly arrived at, something like that. So at most, the population of the world was a fairly small town. When you track the generations and the rate that they had children insofar as they're recorded, you can't get much above 36,000-40,000 people, according to the rate of reproduction that we note at the time. But who knows? 1,000 is probably very low. So the whole earth was of one language, of one speech, or dialect, if you like. Now, there's one other person I want to mention, and I forgot about, before we proceed, and that is Nimrod. Because Nimrod is here also in chapter 10, and it's back there in verse 8. Cush begat Nimrod. Now Nimrod comes from Ham. He comes from the ungodly line. His name means, I will rebel. Something like that. What father would ever give his son the name, I will rebel? Well, it happened. And you see, this was the line of Ham. This family were either idolaters or atheists or something of the sort, and they get a particularly lively baby born that was a rebel in the womb and is kicking and screaming from day one, and they want that. I will rebel. And that's his name. And it's a very apt name. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. This is chapter 10, verse 8. A mighty one in the earth. Well, there aren't many of them. How can you be a mighty one in the earth with something under 40,000 people in the total population? Oh, yes, you can be. I am the one. That was his attitude as he grew up. Obviously, a strapping, strong individual with a violent spirit, wished to be an extortioner and an oppressor and a bully, and he began to be a mighty one in the earth as it was. And verse 9, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Now that may be he was a literal hunter, but certainly in old history, the hunting of lions, say, in the Sumerian Babylonian tradition, that's the sport of kings. It's an aristocratic activity, the hunting in mind here. But it probably isn't hunting of animals that's in mind, but hunting of people. He was a mighty hunter because of this phrase, before the Lord, before the face of the Lord, which strongly suggests something negative or evil that God noted. But he was a tyrant, perhaps. That's the intention of the statement. He was a tyrant, a despot, an oppressor, and a bully. And God saw, a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord, that he was daring and barefaced, the way he bullied society and commanded things. And then verse 10, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. He was the one who, by his initiative, built the city, though the city was never built, but what was meant to be the city and the Tower of Babel. That was his doing. He was the head of this rebellion of mankind at this time, to disobey God and stay right where they were in the plain of Shinar and build a society there. And that's Babel, the gate of the gods, it means. It's Babylon. So this is the beginning of the Sumerian Empire, which became the Babylonian Empire. Here it is with Nimrod. He's the first Sumerian. You won't read that anywhere but in the Bible. Only in Bible history is the Sumerian Babylonian tradition connected with a man named Nimrod. But it's here. And he established it at Babel in the land of Shinar. And so various other things are said. But I go back to chapter 11 and now into verse 3. And they said one to another, go to. What an interesting phrase. Go to. It's used flexibly in the Bible, but it is what it means to say is that a command has been given. It sounds very friendly to us today, but it's a command. You will go and do this. Someone is in charge there. Here are supposed to be a collection of families, and they're all supposed to have their own homesteads. And God hasn't appointed a prime minister or a president or anything of that kind. It's going to be a theocracy. It's a very pleasant, equal society. It's small, but already somebody's the boss. Someone's taken over. It's Nimrod, of course. It's the bully, the tyrant, the hunter of men, the oppressor, the extortioner. And they said one to another, society, there was a chain of command here, and captains, go to. Now they'd invented brickmaking, which is just as well, as there's evidently no stone in that area. They had used stone, so the narrative implied, in previous generations where they'd been, but not now. Let us make brick. and burn them throughly, bake them. And they had brick for stone, which was, of course, much easier to work with. To build something like a huge tower and tall buildings, brick is much easier, or was in those days. And slime, that is asphalt, there's plenty of that in the plain, the old plain of Shinar in Babylonia. Slime or asphalt had they for mortar, and some of the buildings that were built long, long ago, parts of them still exist and stick together tenaciously with asphalt. And verse 4, they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower. They were all going to live in the region, live there and farm there. And the top of the tower may reach unto heaven. Now this is obviously exaggerated language, but it's very suggestive. And it implies that there is a religious significance in this tower. This tower is going to reach up to heaven. Now, I think the best explanation of that is that already, though it isn't stated, it's speculation this, already there was worship of the sun and the moon and the stars, which, as you know, became the Sumerian and the Assyrian and the Babylonian religion. Many gods and the gods of heaven. And it sounds as though it starts even here. From this great observatory, from this high, high tower, we get the very best view of the stars and the moon and so on. We are in that realm, as it were. That's what it means, I'm sure. A tower that reaches up to heaven. Subsequently, they used high hills, hilltops. But there isn't anything like that in the plain of Shinar. So they build a mighty tower. Why, they have a religion, but it's a religion they've invented, we may assume. It's a religion which suits them. What kind of religion would suit Nimrod? I will rebel. Oh, well, a religion, yes, which has no morals, no ethical standards. That's the kind of religion he would want. A religion which requires no conduct from you. A religion which satisfies your craving for belief in God and your instincts, but gods you can manipulate and invent. Gods that will give you good luck or fortune, but demand no moral conduct. So the world is full of Nimrods who have a religion, but it's a religion of their own making. And it's a religion which enables them to really be worshipping achievement, their own power, and their own achievement. The gods help me. I don't worship the gods. I do, but only for favours, because the whole purpose of these gods is to elevate me and secure my good fortune, and so on. So it's a superstitious religion. And so I think there is great significance, religious significance. Why, there's always in... This man is an empire builder. He doesn't want any of those people, be they 36,000, to be dispersed through the world. That would leave him with a very small kingdom. Why, a few dozen nation states carved out of 36,000 people, he's going to be king only of his family. His idea is going to be king and tyrant of everybody. So he wants them in one spot, looking to him. This is part of the defiance of God, not to be spread around the world. And so here in verse 4, it also seems to indicate, I think you'll probably agree with me, that there have been prior instructions in detail about their dispersing to different designated places in the world. I'll read verse 4. I'm sure you'll see it. Go to, chain of command, let us build us a city and a tower, whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name, a reputation, a memorial. Then look at this, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. We don't want that. But has not God said we must go? Has not God instructed us to disperse? Yes, there's that fear in many people that there is a God. And he's commanded this. And the Ebers and those like him keep reminding the population of the world of this obligation to be obedient to God. And it sounds as though the details have been disclosed. We're not going to do that. We're not going to allow the people to be scattered abroad. Of course, the people had a tendency to disperse. Probably sometimes through bad relationships. These are fallen people. Even in a town of 36,000, there'll be quarrels and disputes. And there'll be people who want to go off and do their own thing. There'll be ambition and pride. I'm not staying here under the tyranny of Nimrod. By night we'll depart and we'll go. And we'll find ourselves a place to settle in. We can do it. Pride will take people away to make their own kingdoms. And wanderlust. And then this fear that there is a God and he's commanded them to do it. And there may be a punishment. So how are we going to counter this, says Nimrod? How are we going to keep people all in one place? Well, we're going to build this tower. We're going to create a community in which we're all gathered round a religion, not the religion of this God who wants us to disperse, but alternative religion, and we're going to make people very patriotic. Look what we can do. You've all got brick houses and buildings. We've got this mighty tower. We've got a focal point to look up to hold us together, to be proud of ourselves and our accomplishments. All this is in the psychology to avoid the dispersal of the people. It's a tactic to tie people together, to give them one focus and point of admiration, and it's rebellion against God. Well, this is always the way we see it. To make an empire is always a religious matter. The men making the empire may not think so. I hope you won't think I'm being political if I give this illustration. The people who create the European community may not think this is a religious matter. They may think it's an economic matter, but as far as Satan is concerned, it's a religious matter. It's a matter of controlling, and I'm not telling you to vote in a referendum one way or another, but this is always the way with empires. As far as Satan is concerned, what he has in view, and we can see it working out, from the top will come down the laws, legalize homosexuality and so on, make it an obligation upon society to accept it, respect it, make it a criminal offence gradually over time to ever say anything against it or to oppose it, begin to force employers, possibly even churches, to accept all this. There are umpteen nations wouldn't have thought of that, wouldn't want to do that. Didn't want to proceed with that, but they have to, because it's a European directive. So something which is an intensely religious thing or anti-religious thing has to come into all the laws. The old Soviet Union, was it an economic matter? Was it to stop the tyranny of the Tsars or the perceived tyranny of the Tsars? What was it all about? As far as Satan was concerned, it was about religion. Intense persecution of the Christian faith, and so on. Empires invariably are. People may say, no, this is a trade empire, this is a security empire, this is an empire just to serve the greed and the power lust of some historical emperor. But as far as Satan is concerned, the empire is always a vehicle for him to bring his purposes to pass. And so it was here. Nimrod wants an empire. He wants a consolidation. He wants one group of people only on the earth in one place so that he can plant his false religion. The enemies, the seed of the serpent, can prevail over the seed of the woman. It's the ancient battle of the two nations, the church and the world. It's the story that runs through Genesis and right through the Bible. And that's what we see here as we come through these verses. So we come down to verse 5 in chapter 11. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower. And we find this often in Genesis, the literary style adopted accommodates to the simplest of minds. But of course, we don't say that the Lord literally came down. The Lord knows all things. The Lord is aware of all things. But he inspected, as it were, from on high, the city and the tower which the children of men builded. Difficult to know whether that should be translated had built or were building. But were building seems most likely. And the Lord said in verse 6, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language, and this they begin to do. What has that got to do with it? Well, it's obvious, isn't it, that if you've all got one language, then somebody who wants to consolidate you into one organization, one force, one working group, has an easy task of it. If there's only one language, then the godless can easily infect the godly. And if there's only one language, as soon as they've discovered the joys of cooperation, their pride rises and they trust that they can do anything they want to. And if there's only one language, disobedience can begin to feel normal. You notice this in society. People all think together. If I may mention again, this whole gay homosexuality business, even 30 years ago, most people were against it. Now, most people are accommodating towards it because they think, this is what the media has accomplished, that everybody thinks that way. So people want to think like everyone else. And as soon as the perception comes in, everybody thinks this, everybody does think this. That's how foolish human beings can be. If they've all got one language, well, then, and their disobedience is the thing that's emphasized at the moment, then it'll feel normal. Well, everybody is disobedient to God. Nobody wants to go and disperse around the world. Everybody wants to worship as an alternative the gods of the skies and the heavens. Feels normal because so many people want to do it. And so that's all in the background when it's said here in verse 6, the people is one and they all have one language, and this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them, because all the worst disobedience will feel like normal, as so many people are doing it. Things which they have imagined to do, every evil thing. So God now, and the same language is used as was used to describe them. Go to. In the case of Nimrod, it's indicated a command and a chain of command. So it's as though God says in verse 7, I will command. Let us go down the language of the Trinity and there confound their language that they may not understand one another's speech. The division of speech. In verse 10, this was referred to as the division. It's an amazing thing to have happened. First of all, just consider it. You're working as a bricklayer, and you're talking about how this or that is going to be done, and who's measuring the angle, and you're quite a way up this ziggurat or tower, whatever form it took. And you're cooperating and you need to cooperate. And suddenly, You haven't the slightest idea what your colleague is talking about. Because God has so altered the whole mechanism of language from person to person, and the languages are created. There's no such thing as an interpreter. They'd never heard of an interpreter. It would take years before interpreters appeared. This was astonishing, astounding. This would frighten the life out of most people. This was obviously divine, of God. They were now deeply convicted that they were in total disobedience to God, and his command was not being complied with. And so people would be frightened, alarmed, and afraid of each other. Suddenly, those people you were working with one day, now you're deeply aware they're different from you. You don't like the way they speak. Sounds threatening and rough. And anyway, they have different ancestors. They've come from different parents. They're potentially hostile to us. So the reaction at once is for people to down tools, huddle together in their own tribal or family groups, stick together, realize that they're under the judgment of God, and God succeeds that easily in bringing about obedience to his command. What a gentle judgment. I will not send another flood, says the Lord. And the implication is, if God is going to keep judging by floods, he'll be doing it every few years. Because of the sin of man, he's not going to do that on a regular basis, not until the end of time. So here's a gentle judgment. Nobody died. Well, I suppose you may say somebody may have fallen off a high place because of a misunderstanding, because of the difficulty of communicating. But so far as we know, nobody died. It's a gentle judgment, yet how effective. And it's an abiding judgment. This judgment, which divides the people up and stops them having this one world thing, will last throughout time. Because although we're ingenious and we've got interpreters and we learn each other's languages, we are still divided. It's an enduring judgment. The flood couldn't be, obviously. The flood had to be withdrawn for life to continue. But the confusion of tongues could persist to the end of time. So it's a gentle judgment. It's an enduring judgment. But most of all, it preserves the godly seed. The godly line, the church, has been overwhelmed by the world. Why? Because they're all in one town, one city, one language, one president, Nimrod, the evil one, a great tower going up to the gods of heaven. Human achievement will be their god. Patriotism for your place. Humankind and what we can do, human confidence. Somehow, the godly family have got to be delivered from that. The godly family has got too close to the world, and it's been sucked in. And now there's possibly very few of them, like Eber, if the Jewish tradition is right, who are taking a stand, and they're not involved in the building of this rebellious tower. And God's solution is so perfect, the confusion of tongues. And so the godly line is clear of the mass and drawn out once again. You see it through these pages? The hostility of the world to the church brought to its knees, almost eclipsed and eradicated, and God takes it out again and separates it. As I tell you untiringly, we're seeing it today. The world taking over the church doing all worldly things. You go into congregations, they're supposed to be Bible believers, and sometimes you can't tell whether they're worldlings or Christians. It happens constantly, and God calls his people out, and a remnant is removed from the world. And you see it here. Well, time is up. Let us go down, verse 7, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. And presumably, they now complied with the locations, the destinations that were assigned to them, presumably through the instrumentality of Eber or some such person, that they have rebelled from obeying. But now in verse 9, therefore is the name of it called Babel, which actually means the gate of the gods in the plural. That's what Nimrod called it, the gate of the gods. You've got God, I've got gods. And this is the gate of the gods. But it sounds very like something in Hebrew which means confusion. So there's a play on words here. Therefore is the name of it called, that is, by the church, by the godly line, confusion, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth. And from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of the earth. Now, dear friends, I'm out of time, but I want to introduce to you what God subsequently did. The years passed, and from verse 10, you see all the different families, and then all the way down to chapter 11, verse 27, you're introduced to Terah. And Terah was the father of Abram. And you know how it was that God spoke to Abram, and he told him they were living in Ur of the Chaldees, the record tells us. They were idolaters. We learn that in the book of Joshua, that Terah was an idolater, and they served other gods. But God, they were the godly, supposed to be, and they'd lost their faith. And they were in idolatrous country, and they were worshipping idols. And God put his hand on Abraham and called him out. And he seems to have persuaded his father, Terah, so that he came too. And they began the long journey to the place that God would show them. And Abraham went out by faith from sophisticated, advanced Ur of the Chaldees. And Terah went with him. But they stopped in Haran. Because Terah, though he seems to have been persuaded by Abraham, and he may have decided therefore to give up idols, did not have the stomach for some reason to go all the way to the distant place where God would take them. And we believe that Abraham did not wait until his father died in Haran, that is what we read in the book of Acts, that after the death of his father, Abraham went on with his journey. But Abraham must have left Haran 130 years before Terah died, if we could prove that too, if we look at the ages of his birth, his age when they left the Ur of the Chaldees and so on. He didn't stay there anything like for the rest of the life of Terah. So Terah remained in Haran and Abraham went on. So Abraham alone acted by faith and believed God. How do we explain the Acts 7 reference to Abraham proceeding only when Terah died? Well, the good old interpreters interpret it in this way, that what it means is that when Abraham saw that Terah was dead spiritually, he didn't want to go any further. He didn't have the faith to go further. Or that Terah, because he wouldn't move on, was dead to Abraham, because Abraham's call was, leave your country, leave your father's house. So if old Terah wouldn't come, he had to be settled. No doubt there was great sadness, and Abraham had to proceed by himself, which he did. But I'm coming to conclusion, dear friends. Just in verse 12, here's the great command and promise of God. Now the Lord had said unto Abraham, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. But there'll always be a battle. I will make of thee a great nation, not only literally the nation of the Jews, but spiritually the faithful believers, the Gentile believers in the Church of Jesus Christ, the greatest conceivable nation, will all have faith like Abraham. And I will bless thee and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing, partly because from his line comes the Saviour, and partly because of his own example and influence. But look at verse 3. I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee. This will be a troublesome journey. It'll be a difficult journey. The war goes on. They may have been delivered, particularly from Ur of the Chaldees, but the world will continue to be against the church. The seed of the serpent will be against the seed of the woman, but nevertheless, God will see them through. So that's the beginning of the journey of Abraham, which is where we pick up in due time. The godly line resumes in Abraham. He'll be a tent dweller. He'll be separate from the world. He'll be very patient. He'll have to be. He'll be the father of the faithful. He'll know much affliction, but he will be a pilgrim, a stranger, and a sojourner in this world. And that way, he'll trust and prove the Lord unquestionably. That's our calling too. So we go on with the history of Genesis in future studies. And I think I've tried to explain the deep significance of the Tower of Babel. Let's close singing together the hymn.